Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about soil testing. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at Rock River Laboratory expanding into another state. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the UW Soil and Forage Analysis Lab. In our Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events. We'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Well, we've passed through Christmas and into the new year, so happy new year.
Same to you. First episode of the new year.
We no longer have to look ahead to 2025. 2025 is now.
Doesn't that feel crazy? Like, especially, like, remember Y2K and
yes,
all
I do
the
remember
things
Y2K.
We thought
the world
like
was going to end
crash.
25 years ago.
Even COVID now is like 5 or 6 years ago, really, like when it started. So yeah, it just is, it's crazy to say 2025. Do you guys got a bunch of resolutions, a bunch of things to resolve in the new year?
No.
Can't say that I do. I feel like I'm still kind of in 2024 for a little bit here yet. Haven't quite resolved that one yet, so can't really move into resolving 2025.
But that just means you kept your 2024 resolution all the way through the year then.
Sure. We'll go with that. How about you, Todd? Do you have any New Year's resolutions?
I don't get into that. Usually you just end up being disappointed in a month or two that you didn't keep up whatever you're going to say.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, most New Year's resolutions, at least the ones that tend to see are workout related. Like, oh, I'm going to work out more. I'm going to do whatever more or less. It could be I'm going to eat less or sit in my butt less or stuff like
drink
that.
Drink less.
Well, see, that one, so I do have a college buddy who last year stopped. He was like, oh, I'm going to give up drinking. And it started like, it was going to be like a couple weeks, maybe a month. Ended up going through the whole like AA. So he's like a year sober now. And he had a big thing on New Year's Day. And I'm like, well, good for you.
Yeah.
That's good.
No, that is good.
That's important.
Like,
so he obviously
inadvertently found he had an issue. Like, it's funny, but not funny at the same time of like, he didn't do it because he knew he had an issue. He discovered he had an issue because he did it. So that was kind of interesting. And I haven't seen him. Last time I saw him was at a wedding, probably, I'm going to say, more than 5, but less than 10 years ago. So, I mean, I hadn't seen him in a while. So it was, but yeah, it's good for him. Like, great. If that's something someone needs, that's definitely a good thing and a good reason to have a resolution. So,
are you more apt to have a resolution or give up something for Lent?
I just like
neither.
To give up. I give up giving up things for Lent. Well, so
Lent is nice, as you know, it's that day length and it'll be like resolution. You know, New Year's resolution. This is like usually, like you say, you're doing it forever is what the goal is. So
we do have a guy in the company that is very good at the Lent.
Oh, he
thing.
Loves giving up stuff for Lent.
Yeah, man. And he's. I give him credit because it's.
Oh yeah, it's real.
Like, it's a real deal. Like yeah. he's all in. He's all in. That's cool. But now kind of winter is hit, isn't it? It's cold.
Yeah, for now. We'll see where we go. Because if we'll carry on the manic, depressive weather conditions into 2025. Because I think we were talking a little while ago. It was raining, two weeks ago?
Yep, Friday.
And it was warm. And yeah, now we've kind of fallen back into a sustained period of cold. So I don't mind the rain. It's just when the rain freezes and becomes icy conditions, that part kind of stinks. But
we'll be good till we got to get on that plane to Monterey in a couple weeks for our big convention. Then
we'll have to worry about canceled flights. And
yep.
And last year it was the cold when we went to
right
to San Antonio. It was
pushed back.
We had to take an afternoon flight instead of a morning flight because our morning flight got canceled. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, now in the Midwest, too, there's a big, kind of from the Illinois, Iowa, all those states are getting pounded with snow, and it's going to work its way to the east, so there's areas getting
I get to drive to some weather to Louisville next week. So
it'll snow then for sure.
It can do it all weekend here. Give them a couple days to clear everything out for when I go
skirting south of us.
Where was it last year? Anyway, it was in Indianapolis last year, mm-hmm. So it's pretty much the same. Take the same route. I just have to go further this time, and it was left in a snowstorm and left early to beat the other snowstorm. Like it was bookended snowstorms.
Does that conference no-till conference move around?
Yep. Yeah, I
didn't know that.
For all the times I've gone, it's been St. Louis, Indianapolis, Louisville, and yeah, I think that's the three places it's been. I've heard of it being other places, but it's mostly Midwest. It doesn't go like to Florida or California. I think it's been in Cleveland or somewhere in Ohio. So it's not. It's not one that moves real far. Like St. Louis, Indianapolis, Louisville. You're talking a couple hours difference here and there.
Is the strip till with no-till conference, or is it like
it's the same people that put it on? But that one was in Wisconsin this last year.
Right,
it was in Madison, and that's in the summer. That was in August.
Okay,
I was hoping to get there, but we were gone that week, so I didn't get down to that one. But yeah, that one moves around too. But I don't know.
I always thought they're exclusive. I think is interesting.
Strip till,
yeah, these strip till and the no-tillers are different.
Yeah, I mean it's
they don't play nice together.
I don't know if it's so much that it's just the I guess from a technology standpoint, no tillers aren't looking for equipment other than planter attachments.
Right, it's and different.
Strip till, there's a whole slew industry of different machines. I don't know how many different I've seen Orthmans and a couple other different strip till units, but so I think it's just different sponsors, different people, like. Different management styles a little bit. So not that you couldn't do both. Because I know some farms that do both. And I don't think it's that big of a deal. But apparently enough that they need
that they got to be separate. Yeah.
And why one's in the summer and one's in the winter? That one I'm not really sure. Because most times farmers are less busy in the winter in general. But
right.
Not that August, because I think it was August, is... That can be a slow time.
Well, they probably can have some field demos and stuff potentially. Sure.
Right.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, because you're doing a lot of strip till in the fall, so August might be a little early, but you're right, Todd. You probably could set something up.
Is there a tillage conference?
Not that I know
of. A mow board plow.
Not specifically. Yeah,
just, well, like to other tools, yes. The chisel plow conference.
I think that's just every other conference.
Vertical tillage.
Yeah, that would be interesting if they started a vertical tillage conference. And then they would probably have to have a tillage conference.
Those would be different breakout sessions.
Right.
Moberg plow room, the vertical till room, the fuel cultivator room.
I don't know if you guys have any. I don't really have anybody that's Moberg plowed in the last few years.
No.
But I do, for a fact, know there are still...
No, I've
one's running. I've seen up in the Gillette area, there's one that's like a 10 to 12 bottom.
Oh, yeah.
That I've seen running. So
there's some random, like those guys that have the plow days.
I got a field or two on growers where they'll be plowed because of a plow day, which is actually usually the worst because each plow sort of is different.
Sure. So it's not, consistent across the field.
Yeah, you get different depths mainly into how they slab it over. So it's like this.
And they're like one bottom, two bottom.
Yeah,
right.
Well, one to three bottom.
They don't run like a chisel plow or anything over it afterwards.
Usually it's by the time it happens,
So it's freeze thaw and then whatever they do in the spring to kind of cultivate or whatever.
And
sounds like
fun. One of them I know they don't tell the farmer. Like he's the land, like he rents it and like it'll just be like, oh, they had their plow days and the farmer will be like, what? And I'm like, yeah, it's all plowed up. Like it just
so the landowner does the plow day,
right? And it's almost like a favor thing. You know, the landowner's like, you're welcome, kind of. And it's like, no, it's fine.
I'll skip it next year, but he can't because
right,
it's the landowner.
It just happens.
That's interesting.
So it's always the same field then.
That one is. Yeah. Yeah. They do different parts of the field sometimes. And
well, that yeah. I say, is that worse or better? Like, if they just do like half the field?
Yeah. No. Usually, more of yeah. Usually yeah. Not.
Like, just do the whole length. Just go all the way. Have you ever been present for said tillage field day?
Not.
No.
No.
Should ask for an invite next time. Right, so you yeah. Can get go in on and watch how it. Because I'm assuming if they're using like the little plows, that they're probably using older tractors too.
Right. Usually, most of the fun is out they like want to bring out their old tractors.
80-20R series yeah. John Deere to pull in one bottom plow.
Good point, man. It has less to do with the plow and more to do with.
It's their old Ford or their old Case.
Some old tractor that they want to get out and let her rip.
Yeah.
It's probably picking the front end of the.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm just thinking, yeah, you blow the engine in your little classic tractor trying to pull a two-bottom when it all it can handle is a one-bottom.
We had a neighbor guy growing up, Bill. Remember, he had no seat on the old tractor, so he'd stand and.
Always stand.
Standing.
Everything he did, whether it was raking hay, planting, tillage, whatever he was doing, he would stand.
Stand. I just saw him in the local grocery store.
Did you? And
he looked great, actually. Really?
He's yes. Got to be 80.
Oh, I was shocked to see him because I thought the same thing. Like, holy man, how old are you, Jerome? But yeah.
I know my grandpa's old Oliver when I drive that thing. I don't know if it was always like that or if it just needs new springs, but like it's really hard to drive because the seat's almost like low.
Oh, the low rider
and
style.
And it bounces really bad when you hit stuff. So it's like, it's very hard to drive in bumpy conditions because you're like bouncing all over the place and you're like, it just makes it very difficult. But at least my dad did find a replacement seat for it because the seat was cracked for a long time too, so you had to be careful how you sat. Otherwise, you'd pinch yourself in the seat and have issues ripping your jeans or something. But
keep yourself situated.
That's right. You got to make sure you're sitting in the right position. All right. You guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yeah.
So, Bill, you had... looked back and realized that it's been a really long time since we've talked soil testing, so a good time to bring it back.
Yeah, a lot of, I think, our topics boil around or come up around conversations we have with farmers. It just makes it easy to transition to this platform, but I was having a conversation the other day with a farmer about timing of soil samples, you know, how long should we go between, intensity, those kinds of things. So I thought, oh, I don't remember the last time we talked about it. And I actually went back in our archives, did some searching, and it was episode 4.
Oof.
And we're at 270 if our math is correct right now. So that's quite actually, now we're talking years ago when we talked like specifically about soil sampling. So, and I'm sure the quality of that episode 4 was top notch.
Oh, yeah. early days was, I'm sure, fantastic. We were definitely not any good at that, probably, at all. But anyway.
We got to start somewhere. So
hopefully we're better now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's debatable. I think we're having more fun now.
Well, yep. that's probably true. So
hopefully so are the listeners. But so I guess kind of topics I wanted to talk about here, basically procedure, how do we go about doing those soil samples, what pattern are we using or what type are we using, timing, more so meaning like when is our years of rotation, how quick do we want to come back around and why would we change that. And I think there's a couple different things that we do on why we would change that depending on rotation and what kind of farm we're dealing with, and then also a little bit on depth. UW had some cool things that I really I've kind of thought about, but haven't really dove into it that maybe we should be talking about a little bit more when it comes to depth. Because it's pretty, for what we're doing, it's pretty just a standard 7 inches and we go. But so getting into it, you know, procedure, how are we doing it? And there's really kind of three things. And this is Todd, the really only thing that I kind of stole from episode four.
Yeah.
Most of it's kind of new, but this I kind of I'm gonna put my hand up and say I kind of poached it from you in episode four. But we got the old W pattern, and I know in Wisconsin it's W, and you go to that state across the border, it's an M, but we're going W here. So why would we do W? Less samples per field as far as maybe efficiency. We get just a big a snapshot versus a zoom-in view, capture a larger area. In a pattern versus maybe more intense negatives. There's zero repeatability, right? We're just going out in this pattern and we're grabbing.
You don't walk the same W every time?
No, I don't. Then it would be a geo-reference W.
I mean, so, I guess you could do that.
Right. And it is very time consuming. I know the three of us have had clients over the years that have just said, oh, just go grab a sample and we just don't want to spend a lot of money, just get an idea. And it's like, it's actually a lot easier if we do it our way, easier and quicker.
Yeah, composite samples have their place, but they are, right, like you say, they're a very vague tool just to get kind of a snapshot.
Right.
I had one of these last week, actually. Went out and did a sample in a field because the guy just got it. So it was like, hey, I'm just starting renting this field.
Which is good because
thawed out like, for a day and
we can kind of get an idea on fertilizer,
right?
And then you can really jump in next year,
right? Exactly. So it's kind of the idea, like, okay, I'll just go grab something, so we have something to start with, and then later on we'll go more intensely sample.
So that's kind of the old school, W pattern. Once GIS started coming in 20 years ago or a little bit more than that, we kind of switched over to either grid or soil. Grid or zone sampling, and we do a lot with the grid, which you can tailor your intensity, whether that's, we started way back when at 10 or 5 acres, and then we've chiseled it down to, depending if we want VRT, then we go to 2.5 or less. And I actually saw in some literature from UW that anything under, it was 2-acre grids, really doesn't, and from a cost standpoint really didn't help us. So really thinking that, oh, we better go to 1-acre grids to VRT, it really didn't change much. So that 2.5 is probably where we need to be on if we're going to make a soil rec. Very repeatable. I know all three of us have clients that we can go back, 5, 6, 8 times that we've sampled, and we make those charts to see how the things have changed over the years. So very repeatable. I feel it's very efficient. You go to that point, you get off the ATV and you grab your sample and you go to the next one. I know here at Tilth, we've kind of modified over the years how we've done that, pulling those samples, and whether we're in teams or separate or whatever, but we've kind of changed that. Negatives, you don't get a huge specific sample area that you're taking. And you need to watch out for, obviously, ditches, fence lines, tillage passes, kind of some of those things where you're plopping those points. And I know now we kind of do everything in the field, but years ago, we'd put points maybe beforehand, and you'd get out to the field and be like, well,
why did I do that?
Why did I put that point in this mud hole or this ditch? Or, yeah, this was an old fence line that we combined 3 or 4 fields together. So kind of got to watch that. And obviously you need equipment. Today it's a lot easier. Our old Trimble.
That first Trimble with some sort of field computer that was running an old Windows-based mobile thing. And
the
FarmWorks. We had iPacks for a while too. Yeah, forgot about those.
But yeah, you'd have the little dome on the four-wheeler, and then you had to flip the switch and then check the battery cable because it probably jostled loose from driving across the field. And yeah, good times.
No, even those old iPacks, right? I mean, we had these cases around them. So it was almost like your phone, that thing was, and then you'd get this giant case that clipped on, and the screens would freeze up. They didn't like cold weather, so you'd breathe on them, which was great because you had moisture in your mouth that would...
Or remember when you would be sitting there and the GPS wasn't working, and then you had to change the baud rate, and you'd all the windows.
Right.
Because it had been a couple days since you had to do it, and you're like, oh crap, okay, I gotta go here. Oh nope, that wasn't right. And then what was it set to before? Yeah.
Yep.
a lot more moving parts in that scenario versus now we have iPads with built-in GPS that...
Right, and you can still get a fairly good external GPS for an iPad, too, if you want to be more accurate, and that isn't tens of thousands of dollars like those first GPSs were. And so you are right, Bill. That's gotten way easier, and
we might even still have all that stuff, huh?
I have slowly gotten rid of a few things, like all those iPacks are gone. That original GPS, I think, is still laying around. That thing's going to be a classic because it's got, just the huge base part of it to, like you say, the big dome that you would see. So that thing, you know, even those didn't have, like, GLONASS now. Be fairly accurate, but it wouldn't pick up a lot of those the GLONASS satellites, so it wouldn't be as good today as what even like an internal on an iPad would be. So,
right.
Yeah, it's kind of changed that way too as far as accuracy goes.
Right. So that's kind of the grid sampling. Now, zone sampling where you can, you know, kind of similar to a grid, but you go to a spot, but the zones kind of move and are more, it's not just a square, right, where you're just going to certain points. So you can move those to quirky areas where a grid you can't. You can get out of some of those weird areas, but you have to use something to set the zones. So if you don't have the base data to find that zone, you really can't do a zone. Well, what are you using? Yield maps. We used a lot. Obviously, our Veris machine, the soil EC electroconductivity that Matt loves to run. Probably hasn't run much lately, but...
No, it's been a few years.
Yeah, but we've done that a lot with setting up our zones. Soil type can work, but we feel like there's better options. So
there's more coming down the pipe too with these newer softwares and using imagery. Time, so using like a, you know, basically just sort of the Landsat imagery or some sort of Sentinel or an imagery source, and then having many, many snapshots of those to kind of build that zone. Even those zones can be nice because you can have it generate them and then sort of ground truth it, you know, with your farmer eyes and have the farmer look at it and go, this is weird.
It's kind of like yield data. You can't just compile 6 years of yield data, like six straight years. A lot of times you got to weed out some of the oddball years, like 23 and 24. Like 23 might not be bad, but 24 maybe wasn't. Probably one you wouldn't want to use in that.
19
and 18, probably not want to use those. So, yeah, it's all with a grain of salt there as far as, like, making sure you're looking at multiple factors to design that zone.
One of the suggestions with zones is really think about what your goal is, and that's really just to find like areas in the field and treat them the same. Because I know one of the problems, like with Veris, when Jeff originally made some of those zones, it was like a 1 acre grid
right
out there. Well, then I might as well just 1 acre grid it. Right. Why even go that far? So one of the things to think is like, well, okay, what is a zone of like enough soil that's similar enough that's, you know, hopefully too, like the fertility is close, organic matter is close. And then you sort of group those areas. Not much really different, you know, like when our grandpa farmed, Bill, he had like an 80 acre that was broken up into 10 fields.
Right.
So and each one, zoned
farming.
Right. Those were all original zones. Well, we're kind of going back to that management, but just with precision where you from the tractor don't even realize it's different at all. So one of the things to think about when setting these zones is maybe not using just one source, is trying to using multiple sources, knowing where maybe tile drainage is, knowing some other things that you can kind of start grouping up zones. The other part, like, is size of zone gets hard, is like what is the right size? And it does vary per field, but at the same time, if you're getting, you know, less than 1 acre zones, well, that's too specific. You know, you probably can be somewhere, again, between 2 to 5 acre zones. Maybe upwards of 10 acres if you have a very like area that's all the same, that's okay. So, yeah, a couple of things to think about when you're creating zones.
I did like the EC doing the zones. I remember, Matt, you did a ton of acres for a grower of mine, and we used it more so for, we did it for soil sampling, but we also did it for VRT planting. And I just remember one comment he made was like, he would sit in the tractor, he would look at the field as he was planting, and then his map, and it would like precisely change soil type where the map said it was supposed to. So I feel like the EC stuff is pretty good. Like, that's a good way to do it if you have that ability.
Yeah, but even that, there's, you know, we found through the years, you know, if you're doing it for like research level versus farm level, like
the width,
you could do it, yeah, tighter or.
Well, man, remember that of like, we did ones where it was like,
we did some for UW that was
like every pass, wasn't it, didn't you?
It was pretty close to, yeah, it wasn't quite touching, but because that unit itself was 6-8 feet wide.
Right.
And just your turning radius in a vehicle, pulling with a truck, you can't turn this tight enough, so you'd have to like do every other. And yeah, it was, we did some really tight stuff.
Of all the ones you did, was 45 foot right? Was 90?
I think Varus themselves said between 50 and 60 was like the sweet spot. So I think it's been enough years, I don't remember exactly what we were doing as like the standard, but I want to say
this much turn in the wheel, Matt. Right, like.
Oh yeah, I mean, anything planting and everything else, you get a feel for the machine after a while, and you know, like I used a light bar, but you know, you got pretty good with managing the turn, and or if you'd lose GPS, you could kind of wing it and get it pretty close. But yeah, I think we were around like 45 to 55 somewhere in there most of the time. For bedrock verification stuff, when we were trying to do some of that, we did it tighter. And for research purposes, we did it tighter. But, it's always interesting, some of those technologies. Because that, you know, Varus isn't the only game, just the one we happen to use.
Right.
There's other technologies that were used in a similar way and I think had similar success to it. So just that the practice had a lot of merit to it.
It was good. Timing-wise, I guess for me, we talked more about procedure there than I thought we would. But anyway, timing, I really wanted to dive into. And obviously, we all know that NRCS standard is 4 years, right? That's kind of the what we use for, this is what we have to do. I think a lot of our growers, we've changed to 3 years, and there's really no, I would say, scientific reason behind it. It's more so just gives us a buffer. If we get caught with a late fall, or the farmer tills the field before we can get there, or the manure tanker's there before, it gives us that ability that we're still in compliance. You know, that third year, we're still in compliance that fourth year if we have to wait an extra one. So
I think we had the ones you do over a 4 year span or more, you do see enough changes that I think over time, like you say, there's not necessarily like we've got any internal research on the 3 year. We've just seen that it does work well, that 2 years seems to be sometimes a little too much and 4 is too long. So yeah, just sort of that maybe just right. But I know you got some literature here, Bill, that kind of helped dial
it in. Found some stuff from Michigan State as well as UW on actually some potential science behind why you would want to do that. And Michigan State said for most cropping situations, systems, soils, and they were talking about actually 3 years versus the 4. Sampling in a 3-year period is adequate on most fields, nothing that you should worry about. Soil pH, nutrient levels that are stable in a more high CEC type situation fields, we're good with 3. Don't worry about even going to 2, those kinds of things. But in sandy soils, when we have low CEC, potassium, magnesium, and calcium levels can change more rapidly because of leaching or crop uptake, just because of that CEC level. So in these soils, they're actually recommending, you know, you go more frequently. So maybe every other year. I would think maybe in some high value crops. I know we know a consultant in Michigan that's doing some potatoes. I guess I've never asked her how much they soil sample, but maybe in that sense they're doing every year.
They seem to go more often, less dense though.
Sure.
You know, not always, but potatoes are more grown on sandy soils that are fairly alike So they can go 10 or 20 or 40 acre composite, but go every year.
Are you seeing that in with, like, with your dairies that work with those guys?
Well, in like just areas that have, you know, that, like I said, that are in Wisconsin in the Central Sands, that's more of a typical practice that they were doing. And then they're watching pH a lot, you know, for lime, any sandy soil, we're trying to watch pH more. Well, then it does help actually if you do it more often, because you start to see those ups and downs. Yeah, that sure. If you're doing every 3-year snapshot, pH gets really tricky.
Well, it's that whole know, like, did it revert low, revert and back? Then you hit it with lime and you pop it high.
Well, right. And then it goes, did it revert back? Did right. it? Did the lime not do as well? Did the lime do its job and it's done already? So yes, it does seem to be very specific. Yeah, I like what they've got. You know, what Michigan State's advice here seems to be actually quite good to what we've seen to work well, too.
And similarly, the stuff I read from Wisconsin is that they recommend every 4 years to monitor fertility and pH. They're seeing that crop removal over a 4-year time frame in our row crop system doesn't change enough to recommend going higher in some, except for some exceptions, right? There's always an exception to the rule. And I think this exception actually plays well into our business quite a bit. Crops with high removal rate, corn, silage, alfalfa. There isn't a day that goes by that probably any of us on this podcast don't deal with corn, silage, or alfalfa. So there's an exception to the rule that you may want to sample more frequently because of those high demand crops, especially to monitor, you know, P, but I think K, you know, especially. And then similarly to what Michigan State said, sandy and loamy sands should be done every 2 years. Since their nutrient content, pH can change faster due to that lower buffering capacity on that low CEC. So we have those low CECs, things can change quite a bit. So those would be fields where we would want to monitor more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, we know just from other management types that not all soils are created equal, so it makes sense that there'd be variations depending on soil type, and obviously economics play into it as a big factor too. You get a benefit from soil testing. I don't think anyone who does soil testing would deny that, but the more often you're taking the soil samples, the higher your costs get and the more frequent. That's why, you know, the 1-acre grid thing gets pretty cost prohibitive,
right?
When you're running a lot of acres, you know, so it makes sense that there would be some variation there, but just being, I think, having some consistency in how you do it has some merit as well.
Yeah. Seasonality, kind of moving on here, seasonality to our soil sampling. I think it's pretty well given that if you should stick with the season, like pick a season and stick with it. We're not so sure that we care what season that is. We do a lot in fall because of timing and just it's an easier transition for us. There's so much more going on in the spring. But there could be some ramifications to that, and I guess that's where we want to talk a little bit here is some seasonality things. pH and P are typically higher in early spring than in the fall. So basically these are things that could affect your soil test and why you would want to stay. If we're going to stay spring, let's keep doing spring. If we're in the fall, let's keep doing fall. Because if we're starting to compare spring and fall samples, we might have some funky things that pop up. K results may be higher in the spring as compared to the fall on lower testing fields. So if you have a low testing field, that actually could be a little bit higher than you would expect if you sampled it in the spring. But on higher testing fields, so if you have fields that have manure history, just you've done a good job fertilizing, whatever it is, K may be testing lower as compared to the spring. So a little bit things there where you got to kind of watch that. And that's all clay mineralogy and how potash or potassium kind of sticks to the soil in spring versus fall. Some other things like spring, summer, fall, kind of those like weather windows, you could kind of almost say like soil temps are lower in the spring. So it's going to slow down microbes and decomposition and nutrient cycling. So that could affect what your soil test looks like. In the summer, obviously the temps warm up. So decomposition, microactivity, all those things are now changed. I just talked about spring. Now in the summer, we're ramping that up, which could lead to more N depletion. So your N, we didn't talk a lot about N yet, but most of the time we could see that in the summer, maybe some of that gets decomposed faster because of the warmer temps. And one thing that I found was interesting in the fall on corn grain fields. So we have a lot of silage, so we're taking all that residue away. You know, where it's easily to know that that's not a credit anymore. But we could actually find that, especially on K, that if we're sampling those fields right after grain harvest versus maybe a month later, that we could get a vastly different number. We just don't have that K leaching out of the plant residue if you're sampling it right after versus maybe if you waited a month and you got some rains that leach some of that out. So just some things to think about. Like, I don't know that I would take any of this in the seasonality portion here and just change the way I do it based on that, but just some things to consider when you're doing spring and fall sampling and why you'd want to just stay with one. And then last thing here on soil sampling is the depth. And I guess I didn't do a lot of thinking about this, but I think some of it makes sense. And some things that UW put out, sampling at different depths based on your cropping practices. So if you're plowing fields, we want to hit to that plow layer. And when I say plow, we're not going back to talking about mow board plowing. It's just in general, if you're doing tillage, get to that plow layer, which is usually, you know, 6 to 8 inches. And I think for the most part, a lot of things we do is at 7. So we're right in that sweet spot. For minimum or no-till, you could consider 2 to 4 inches on pH. Obviously that soil could stay, at a certain pH because of you're not mixing the soil. So maybe consider a little bit shallower to kind of monitor that pH. And for fertilizer recs, because we want to capture that whole rooting zone, you want to be at that normal 6 to 8 inches. And I think we don't maybe do enough of that, of pH monitoring.
Well, and just testing for stratification, right, in general, I agree. There's times where I've tested for it and haven't found it, and there's times where I tested for it and have, and knowing which depths, then it just adds another dimension that is tricky. You know, we're talking about time and amount, and now you got, if you add that, this dimension of depth in here too, it gets really tricky on how to watch those samples and how many to take.
Right. It's hard too if you're you don't want to necessarily sample every field twice either if you're looking for fertilizer recs to just sample shallow.
Right.
So maybe doing a composite pH if you know.
Or like you say, a composite of stratification. Just see like at a few areas or in that W, go those depths to see what you get.
Yeah, because I will say from the stratification stuff that I've done, I'm not saying I've done a lot. It's there, but it's not as severe as you see in other places. Like I've seen some stuff out of Illinois where it's, 200 parts per million different at the top to 6 or 7 inches down. And I haven't seen that in a Wisconsin soil. So I think your soil types and everything will play into that a lot too.
And the last one is perennial crops. So this could be grasses or alfalfa. The recommendation is the normal 6 to 8 for when you're doing a seeding year, and then actually 4 inches throughout the maintenance of that life of that stand, which is interesting because it's something we don't do. I mean, normally we stick at that 7 inches. So thinking that again, we're not tilling that soil, that more of those nutrients are going to stay in the top 4 inches. So that's where you're going to sample. So just some food for thought there on depth. But I was hoping that the main driver home here was how to determine, like, should I be sampling more often? Should I be sampling at 3 years? Should I be sampling at 2 years? And I think when you put yourself in those boxes of, okay, I have sandy soils, I really should be sampling every other year. Maybe that's a consideration that farmers should take into account is, nope, I have heavy soils, a lot of manure, we're probably good at 4, maybe 3 to have those buffer years in case we have an issue. But otherwise, you know, that's kind of where we sit.
I'm going to go with the Nike philosophy. Just do it. at least having your some soil samples, whether it's 4, 2, 3, you know, having a data set and trying to be consistent, I think, is just as important. And, yeah, if you can make adjustments that will help your operation, that's fantastic. But just, I know we say it a lot, and maybe we say it enough, but maybe not. Just doing soil sampling to begin with, having that baseline to build off of is important. So, all right. With that, we'll move into our spotlight for today. So Rock River Laboratory will be expanding into South Dakota to look to supply the Great Plains with accurate beef and nutrition data. Rock River Laboratory Incorporated is expanding to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, offering access to feed and forage analysis tools, insights for beef and dairy operations. The lab continues the company's tradition of exceptional customer service and support. Rock River Labs South Dakota will take over the former Ag Lab Forages, which has served Great Plains nutrition consultants and industry partners using Rock River Laboratory's deep breadth of calibration for years. So Mike Barber and his team have done an excellent job serving the Great Plains region, and we hope to build the foundations they've set, according to Zachary Meyer of Rock River Labs, as he serves as their CEO, with localized access to additional tools, technical support, and expert insights that accompany our analysis results. Nutrition consultants and their farms have new means to dial in their herd's nutritional needs. So they'll be using near-infrared spectroscopy, or NIRS. The lab offers a wide array of comprehensive analysis options and decision-making tools, accompanied by expertise in the field. So one of our past guests on the podcast is also quoted in this article. We're creating opportunities for a new territory of nutritionists and their herds to access accurate data that can showcase ways to improve their bottom lines and help them thrive, according to Dr. John Gazer, Animal Nutrition Research and Innovation Director for Rock River Labs.
Nice, Dr. J.
So Rock River Labs, Dr. John. South Dakota will be, or it's now accepting feedstuffs and forages for analysis. Interested parties can set up an account at rockriverlab.com or give them a call. So
it looks like it's like right in town in Sioux Falls. So I don't know, that can't be right. Where is this location? I was just looking what's, you know, I was like where they build them.
Like the Dairyland Labs. Downtown Sioux Falls.
The Dairyland Labs in De Pere, that's like right by a Menards and a Walmart. And then
well, it was an old fitness place, yeah. It's right under a billboard. That's
most random shaped building ever.
Yes.
Have you found it?
Not well, but because I think where they ship the samples and where, you know what I mean? Like where the, I don't know. Yeah, so no, I have not. We'll have to ask Dr. John next time about the Sioux Falls, South Dakota South location. Dakota
expansion.
Because, yeah, this just looks like it ends up in a strip mall next to a juice stop,
a Golden Bowl, like a Jamba Juice,
Chinese restaurant, a pet store, and Bagel Boy. Oh. Bagel Boy.
I'd like to see one of these times, like an old Hardee's or something,
into a lab.
Like a drive, have a drive-through,
it's
so you can just drop
Chinese
stuff off.
Chinese restaurant, though.
Or, Chinese
like,
restaurant.
No, I mean, like a Hardee's, they usually switch them over to a Chinese restaurant.
I've seen El Hardee's at a Mexican restaurant.
Yes,
they turn into a lot of fun stuff.
I think there was like a, I think a Hardee's became a Chinese restaurant or something in Point once. I don't remember what it used, I'm trying to remember now. Been too many years, but yeah, it's always fun to see those.
There's a Culver's across the road, so that makes sense.
Why would you not put a lab there?
Yes.
Why wouldn't you put a Culver's in your lab?
Wait.
Just like the...
I don't think Craig would approve of that.
Is it the Devonta Adams does those? Taco Bell in his house?
Yep.
Should start doing some Culver's commercials like that. Taco Bell, there's a Culver's in my lab. What? All right. Anyway, now we'll move on to our Ag History Minute. So today we're talking UW Soil and Forage Analysis Lab and the move to WSLH, which is the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. And the WSLH was established in 1903 as part of UW-Madison and serves as the state's official public environmental and occupational health laboratory. Provides an analytical services, research and development, public health programs, laboratory proficiency testing and training, and education of students and professionals. So that's a pretty big operation when you combine all those things together with soil and forage analysis as well. So kind of cool that that's been around for a long time, over 100 years. And we're in 2025 now. I got to keep remembering that because it is 2025 now.
Remember.
So instead of 121 years, it's 122 years, depending on what part of the year. But
close enough.
But you're right, man. That is interesting that it started in the like
early 1900s.
So. That long ago, and then that it was just in the lab of hygiene is just wild. Because, yeah, I'm sure they just had lab space that they could use in certain things and decided we need to know what our soil tested. So
yeah, I'm sure it's a lot easier to expand laboratory space within an existing lab than try to start from scratch.
That one, though, seems like the opposite of high. Let's bring a bunch of dusty, dried soil into our lab.
Water
hygiene.
Testing lab?
Yeah, and like, yeah.
It's true, know. But I'm guessing there's probably not a lot of overlap between the two.
Right.
And they probably weren't testing a lot of manure samples.
No,
back then.
Hopefully not.
Yeah, we just tested some hygiene-based stuff. Here's your pee test, and now we're going to do a manure sample. Okay.
I wonder if the results ever got flip-flopped.
Yeah, we really got to talk about your diet.
Yeah.
You're
very high in phosphorus.
Your phosphorus is way off the charts. It's unfortunate.
All right, thank you, Matt and Bill, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's very easy. All you need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone or in an Android phone. Download an app like Podcast Addict, and there you can find us as well. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right, now it's time for some cool beans that's corny and some current events. So cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans.
Cool beans. Our cool beans this week. EPA has registered Nemaxa, a bionematicide soybean seed treatment.
Say that 10 times fast.
So Nemaxa with two X's. Will be the first seed treatment in soybean to contain three unique biological strains. Soybean cyst nematode is responsible for nearly 1.5 billion with a B in lost yield each year across North America. So, as I mentioned, it's the only triple strain bionematicide seed treatment for season-long nematode protection in soybeans and corn, according to its manufacturer, UPL Corp. Nemaxa, which will be available to treat soybeans for the 2025 season, is effective against the most damaging nematodes, including soybean cyst nematode, root knot nematode, and reniform nematodes. Nemaxa bionematicide. I love this article because they have to keep following it with that. Can't just call it Nemaxa, apparently. Uses a combination of three biological strains, including two that function as bionematicides and root colonizers to control nematode eggs and juveniles. Because Nemaxa colonizes along the roots, it forms a barrier of protection that grows as the roots grow to prevent nematodes from burrowing into roots, feeding on plant tissue, and laying eggs. The third unique biological strain delivers biostimulant activity to stimulate root growth and help plants remain resilient through the season. So it's good to know that we're getting more tools in that toolbox because soybean cyst nematode is a nemesis for certain. All right. Now we'll move into our cool beans. That's corny. That was the cool beans. Officials are warning that an agro-terrorism threat is real. So FBI officials in a recent workshop explained that an agro-terrorism attack on the U.S. could result in disruption of agriculture production, export markets, or food security. So ag is considered vulnerable when it comes to terrorism threats by enemies of the U.S. Stephen Goldsmith, an FBI management and program analyst, and Scott Malik, a FBI agent in the Milwaukee field office, warned that attendees of a recent workshop that farms, agribusinesses, and the food supply are all at risk of being attacked in one way or another by people with nefarious intentions. They cited the intentional introduction of contagious diseases, attacks on biotechnology research, and contamination of the food supply as being among the most serious concerns. If it scares you, it scares me, but you will have to tell me why you're scared, Goldsmith said during his presentation. If you see something that looks suspicious, you need to call local authorities immediately. Malik said the FBI can't go it alone and when working to protect agriculture and other sectors of the economy from terrorism threats that occur every day across the country. He said we will work with our subject matter experts in the field, with Food and Drug Administration, law enforcement, and the private sector. We have to come together to talk about the information we have available and formulate a plan of how to address it. So biosecurity concerns are amongst the biggest threats there, and Goldsmith said millions of baby pigs are raised in North Carolina each year and millions of bushels of corn grown in Iowa. Said, but biosecurity concerns when millions of pigs are on the road at any one time. So obviously all the moving parts mean there's different opportunities to introduce something. A biosecurity test. A government official visited a large farm recently, walked up with to a pen of cattle and threw a towel with a rock in the middle of the pen. No one on the farm noticed, and the cattle all gravitated toward the towel to see what it was. So I guess that's one thing to consider, is just knowing what's going on the farm at all times. I think we've seen that over the years with even just issues on individual farms when you have employees maybe doing something they shouldn't be. So having a way to be aware, or as aware as possible, of what's going on in your farm is a big part of what they're suggesting, as well as obviously phones and computers can be hacked as well. So be on your guard, I guess, is the moral of that story. And now we'll wrap things up with a Feel Good Friday this week. The Gift of Giving Oklahoma 4-H member starts a toy drive that now gives out 13,000 toys each year. Just 11 years old, Reed Markham had an idea for a project to collect toys and give them to children in his community. 8 years later, the toy drive has given away more than 64,000 toys at an annual event people wait in line for hours to attend. So he came up with the idea back in 2016. He said, when I realized that I wanted to help put another toy under someone else's tree that year, at just 11 years old, he thought he'd start collecting toys. Came home one day, talked to his mother and stepfather, and said, Mom, I want to help someone or some kids in my class for Christmas. I said, okay, what can we do? It could take a little work. And he was like, nope, I want to give out toys. So he started as a small idea, giving out a little bit at a time. The first year, his small idea turned into a huge success by giving out around 5,000 toys at his stepfather's law office. And as I said earlier, by this year, they're up to giving away 64,000 toys. So that's pretty crazy. A pretty cool thing for that kid to do. So
that's really, they got like pictures of the cars lined up miles and
yeah,
it's neat. It's really cool.
3 to 4 mile long line for the toy drive. So good for him. And hopefully they'll be able to carry this on into future years. All right, well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
Thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.